Thanks very much for that lovely introduction, and thanks very much for inviting me to give a talk again. So yes, the title of my talk is indeed A Courtesan, a Killer and a King. That is gratuitous alliteration, the mark of a poet. And it gives me an opportunity, I chose this title, it gives me an opportunity to do something I really love, which is to tell you stories based on the early Buddhist texts in the Pali Canon. And these are, I'm going to tell you some stories about three characters, obviously, three characters. So there's a kind of theme that's been running through Sanghanite over quite a few weeks, months even, heroes of the Dharma. So you've heard, some of you have heard about heroes of the Dharma such as Milarepa. You heard about Milarepa, yeah? Nagarjuna, Shantideva, various other characters. And it occurred to me that the characters I'm going to talk about tonight are not really heroes at all, especially not the killer, as you could imagine. I'm more interested here in a way, interesting, not ordinary is the wrong word, characters, unusual characters who became disciples of the Buddha. And anyway, this, you know, it's great hearing about inspiring, enlightened followers of the Buddha. That's great, they can inspire us. But we may not feel that they're quite like ourselves. If that makes sense. We may feel they're perhaps a little remote. Well, we may feel that a courtesan and a killer are a bit remote, but perhaps they're more ordinary, more, and in that sense, they might have something different to say to us. So there you go, that's by way of introduction to the theme here. Firstly, a courtesan by the name of Ambapali was a disciple of the Buddha. Ambapali, it means something like somebody who looks after mangoes. which I guess, it's, I mean, these days you get women's names named after flowers, don't you? Women called Rose and so on. So this is perhaps being a woman who looks after mangoes was a name of the time. So Ambapali, she was a courtesan in ancient India, in Vaisali, a place that's just north of the River Ganges in northern India. So a courtesan, a ganikar. We don't really have these anymore. If I was to say that she's a high-class prostitute, that creates a certain sort of impression in your mind, doesn't it, of somebody whose living is perhaps like that of a prostitute, but like a very good one or something. But what do I know? But actually, it's slightly different. At this time in ancient India, a ganikar was a highly respected person or woman. Perhaps a little like a geisha, if I understand geisha properly in Japan. There are very accomplished women who cater for, who entertain, as it were, high-class men, kings, merchants, and so on. And so we don't know a great deal about her. And what I'm going to tell you about is very much just drawn from the earliest texts. The Buddhist tradition, as most traditions, they like to elaborate their stories. So the later commentaries on these Pali texts filled in lots of backstory and detail, but I find it a bit stereotyped or cliched, and I quite like just what we get in the early texts, which is often a bit fragmented or incomplete, but it has a bit of a sense of, oh, this may possibly relate to something real, although in another way we have to relate to them as stories. We just don't know how historically accurate these accounts are. So Ambapali, we're told, was a courtesan who had a grove, a mango grove, near Vaisali. And she went there having heard that the Buddha was staying in her mangrove, she must have made it available to visiting wandering ascetics like the Buddha and his monks. So after he delivered a Dharma talk to the monks, after she'd visited him and he'd given to her a Dharma talk, a talk on the basics of the Dharma, Ambapali invited the Buddha and his monks to a meal at her house. This is a tradition in those days that lay followers of the Buddha would, as it were, show their devotion, their dedication by offering a meal to the monks who didn't. They had a practice of not cooking and depending on the lay people for all their food. And he accepted. Then she got back in her chariot and driving back towards the city, coming the other way, were a whole lot of chariots of the Lichavi youths. These are a sort of high-class bunch of youths from Vaisali, renowned for their fine clothes, their upright bearing. You know, they're a kind of... I'm trying to think of a kind of comparison today. The kind of glittering good boys of Vaisali, all dressed up, looking very fine. And as she passed them, she sort of taunted them. Ha, 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 he's coming to my house for dinner. which caused them to indulge in a certain verbal abuse, that mango lady. And it was true, when the Lichavi youth got to the mango grove where the Buddha was staying, and they invited him to dinner themselves, he said, no, I've already accepted the invitation at Ambapali's place. So the Buddha the next day went to eat with her. She sat on a low stool and again he gave her a Dharma talk, and she bequeathed to the Buddha and the Sangha her mango grove. So out of devotion, she gave the monks her mango grove as a place they could just use, they could stay at. So that's all we know about Ambapali, the courtesan. And we could wonder, well, what exactly did Ambapali, this courtesan, respond to in the Buddha's teachings? And I think we get a sense of this from some poems that she's said to have written later. So later in life, Ambapali became a Buddhist nun. She went forth and became a nun, joined the Sangha. And some of her verses are preserved in a collection called the Terigata, the stanzas of the early Buddhist nuns, who you're going to hear a lot more about next week from Vimalavadri, who's going to talk about this. I hope I'm not taking things. There's a lot of other verses, aren't there? So Ambapali's stanzas, they're very moving. She reflects on ageing. So you can imagine a woman who, in her youth, was extremely beautiful, so beautiful she could make her living from being a courtesan. And so later, it's just a selection. Black as the black colour of bees were the curls of my hair, but age makes them like hemp bark fibres. The truth speaker's words were not untrue. So that last refrain, the truth speaker's words, that's referring to the Buddha as the speaker of truth. Scented like a basket full of flowers was my best part, my head, but age makes it smell like dog's hair. The truth speaker's words were not untrue. Like bright shining jewels, my eyes were dark and large. But age has long ruined their beauty. The truth speaker's words were not untrue. My singing was as sweet as the wood-wandering nightingale, but age finds me faltering at each note. The truth speaker's words were not untrue. you could imagine a courtesan would have sung. That would be one of her accomplishments. Formerly, each of my thighs was as splendid as an elephant's trunk. But age has made them look like bamboo canes. The truth speaker's words were not untrue. Like that was this mass of flesh and bones, now very aged, a place of many pains, an old house, its plasterwork crumbling. The truth speaker's words were not untrue. So there's 20 of these verses, all like this, describing various aspects of how she experienced her ageing body. And I think this gives us perhaps a clue about some what it was that drew Amber Pali to the Buddhist teaching. If you imagine a courtesan in ancient India, in a way, and this is borne out by that story of her taunting the Lichavi youths, she's an independent woman. It's one of the few ways to be an independent woman in those days. So not only independent but respected, and not only respected but wealthy. Independent, respected, wealthy woman. But dependent on her accomplishments, her good looks. And I imagine that she might have met the Buddha, who after all was somewhat of a celebrity of his day. She might have met him. And he perhaps very unusually would have related to her just as a person. Yeah? Although she's great looking and all that. It's not that the Buddha wouldn't have noticed, but that just wasn't what the kind of thing that he particularly paid attention to. He's a bit firm like that, you know, just relates to people as human beings. And perhaps that was an unusual thing in her experience, for someone just to relate to her as she is, as a human being. And I imagine, when you think about the significance of the truth speaker's words were not untrue, that when he gave her Dharma teachings, what he might have done was remind her, you know, now you're very beautiful, but watch it. It won't always be like this. It's worth taking a bigger view of the picture, of the situation, not just relying on your good looks for your identity, but looking at the way what it is to be a human being involves ageing. And that would, of course, been a clue for her of what to cultivate, to look into in her human experience. What aspects of her life she needed to develop further, perhaps her mental state, to turn towards her mind really, rather than just looking after her accomplishments. So we see there the Buddhist teaching appealing to not just to kind of mystics, dreamers, spiritual aspirants, the kind of people that we might think of the Buddha's teaching as stereotypically appealing to. But here, it appeals directly to someone with a very different approach to life, very different set of interests. I mean, somebody who's a high-class courtesan is presumably quite realistic in a certain way, down to earth. Concerned with her looks and so on. But she was drawn to the Buddha's teaching. And in fact, her wealth is what allowed her to give a mango grove to the Buddha. So that's my first character, Amber Pali, who's perhaps an unusual or interesting character, unlike perhaps the young people who were drawn to the Buddha in quest of spiritual awakening. Now, to go even further in this direction of unusual characters attracted to the Buddha's teaching, there's Angulimala. Probably a lot of you have heard of Angulimala, the serial killer. His name means finger necklace. Bit of a giveaway, that, isn't it? So Angulimala was so called because he wore a necklace of his victim's fingers. Now, why would he do that? it's a bit mysterious. We don't really find out. The scholar Richard Gombrich has put forward the theory that perhaps he was an early practitioner of a kind of extreme form of tantrism, whereby there was some sort of spiritual gain in chopping off people's fingers. But other scholars have disagreed very strongly that there was any such tradition, which is a bit of a relief, isn't it? But even the Buddhist tradition itself has maintained the story that Angulimala's pursuit of fingers was connected with his desire to impress a spiritual teacher. Now, however misguided this might be, it suggests that this character Angulimala was in a way involved in some in serial killing as a way to in some sense learn something or get some result. It wasn't a kind of random thing. So we can perhaps think in those terms. There's a kind of premeditated effort to get some benefit out of creating this necklace of fingers. Anyway, you could imagine in lawless ancient India, well, it's not so much lawless as there wasn't the rule of law that we're used to, that the countryside where Angulimala lived was, the people were completely terrified. They never knew, of course, if they were to go out on their own, whether they'd come back, or at least they'd come back with all their fingers. A part of the countryside in Kosala was basically off limits for most people. Now, the Buddha heard about this, and it said that he just set out and walked into that piece of countryside towards Angulimala. People warned him not to do that, warned him of the dangers of doing so. But he took no notice and just walked towards this serial killer. And it's said that the bandit, Angulimala, saw the Buddha approaching from a distance. Seeing him from a distance, Angulimala thought, how extraordinary. People usually come in big groups in order to try and escape me. But even then, they don't succeed. What's this person doing, just coming on his own? Surely he's asking to be deprived of his life. And he headed off towards the Buddha. But he found, to his consternation, that the more quickly he ran towards the Buddha, the less he was able to catch up with him. In terms of the story, this is like there's a theme basically of the supernatural. There's a sort of supernatural element to this story to kind of explain a moral point. So he couldn't catch the Buddha, no matter how hard he tried. And in the end, he just shouted out, "Stop, ascetic, stop." To which the Buddha replied, "I have stopped, Angulimala. Why don't you stop?" Which was a perplexing thing to say. And Angulimala thought to himself, well, I've heard that these ascetics always speak the truth, so what on earth does he mean? And then follow these verses which explain the situation. Angulimala says, "Ascetic, while walking you say, I have stopped. While of my being stopped, you say, you have not stopped. Ascetic, I ask you the meaning of this. In what sense you have stopped, but I have not?" The Buddha replies, "Angulimala, I have altogether stopped by refraining from violence towards all beings. But you are unrestrained towards living beings. Therefore, I have stopped, but you have not." So, in terms of the story, this is using wordplay in this sort of context of a supernatural kind of theme to get across a kind of exchange between these two characters. That's the important thing. And then Angulimala says, "At long last, for me, a revered great sage has come to the forest speaking the truth. I will now live renouncing evil, having heard a stanza about your teachings." So Angulimala is converted, basically, by this supernatural trick, you could say. "So the bandit took his weapons and sword and threw them into a deep rocky pit. The bandit fell at the perfect one's feet and right there asked for the going forth. Then the Buddha, great compassionate sage, the teacher of the world with its gods and men, uttered the old words, 'Now come, monk.' And just that turned him into a monk." So actually, Angulimala not only converted to the Buddhist teaching, but on the spot became a Buddhist monk. And later on, he was quite a close follower of the Buddha by the sound of it, and quite a devoted, steady monastic practitioner. But when people in the local town found out that it was Angulimala, this former serial killer, who was on alms round with the Buddha, you can imagine their consternation, and they would generally throw stones at him. You can imagine they may have deprived family members of life. You're not going to really want to give him his dinner, are you? And the Buddha counselled Angulimala when this happened, just be patient, by going forth and becoming a monk, you've avoided many lifetimes in hell. In the language of rebirth, Angulimala would have deserved rebirth in hell for a long time. And by going forth and practicing the Dharma, he's avoided that. So the Buddha just counsels him just to put up with it. At least you're not going to hell. Because he does become an arahant. So, this raises the question of what was it that Angulimala, a serial killer bent on killing, and good at it by the sound of it, what did he see in the Buddha? What did he get from the... What attracted him to the Buddha's teaching? What appealed to him? And the story of Angulimala not being able to catch up with the Buddha is an image. And then these words of Angulimala saying, "Stop!" And the Buddha saying, "I have stopped, why don't you stop?" This kind of wordplay gives us a way into a kind of how the Buddha communicated with Angulimala. But it doesn't altogether, I don't think, explain what the connection might have been. And I think one way to think about it is that perhaps the Buddha, in some sense, managed, again, as with Ambapali, to connect as a human being with this person who most people would have been scared stiff of. Yeah, you wouldn't normally go and hang out with serial killers in order to get into conversation. But it looks like that's what the Buddha attempted to do. And this was just... I explored this thought back at the Buddhafield Festival back in July. A group of us were one morning studying the Angulimala Sutta and trying to work out what was it that changed Angulimala's mind. And we did come down to this idea that perhaps for the first time Angulimala just connected with another human being who wasn't scared of him. Yeah, and that allowed him to see another perspective on life. And one of the men that we were that was there in my little study group came up with this amazing story. He said he'd been in I think it was New York or some American city, and I mean he was just a slightly quite a scholarly sort of chap who happened to be at the Buddhafield Festival. And he was saying that he was walking through the city and a guy tried to mug him. Yeah, a guy tried to mug him. And he said, almost spontaneously, he said to this guy, "You shouldn't do that. I don't deserve it." And the guy who was trying to mug him said, why not? And Peter said, it was a black man trying to mug him, and he said, I've opposed apartheid all my life. I'm on your side, basically. And this guy was saying, well, you know, it's really tough. I don't have any money. You know, people are prejudiced against me because of my skin colour and so on. And they got into a conversation. So, and in the end, Peter, who had, the black man had tried to mug, gave him some books on the Dharma to think about. And we were sitting around thinking, wow, he's in the study group. I think this is very impressive to hear about this. We weren't thinking that Peter was the Buddha, but that just we were just reflecting on how just connecting with people can make a tremendous difference in a very unexpected way. You don't know what's going to come out of it. And presumably the Buddha was more confident than most in his ability just to connect and get across a different perspective on life. There you go. Running out of time a bit, but I watched a movie recently called The Dhamma Brothers. Any of you heard of this movie? 2007. It's very good, isn't it? It's about these prisoners who are in these American prisons in the deep south for life, basically for murder. They've all done murders of some sort, and their outlook is not very positive, really. They're very unlikely to be released. And a lot of them have taken up Vipassana meditation in the Goenka tradition. And watching this movie made me think about Angulimala. For these men, they don't have much hope left in their life. When you've done something as bad as murdering people, you don't have a lot of emotional, mental comfort, as it were. You don't have a sense that life is going to be kind to you, or in this case, that you're going to get let out of a prison. And for them, taking up meditation was extremely serious. Once they'd engaged with the process of meditation and changing their minds, it was something that wasn't an option for them. It actually gave them a way to see the world in a very different way and actually do something about their situation in the most direct way. And I could imagine Angulimala being like that. Once he got into communication with the Buddha, it was perhaps the case that he could see that the only possible way out for him now was working on his mind very intensively. You can't bring the people you killed back to life. You can't persuade people that was okay, really, or something. All he could do was work on his own mind. So it's a bit all or nothing, really. And the Buddha made that possible for him. And that's a great gift, I think. Gosh, I'll quickly do this king then. Actually, the king's a slightly different character. This is King Passenadi. The Buddha had two or three friends who were kings. He had a good king friend called Bimbisara, who was very devoted to him. But unfortunately, King Bimbisara was murdered by his own son in that kind of bad king way that you get in Game of Thrones. You know, it's actually seems to actually go on in at least in ancient India. So his son murdered his father, took over the throne, and the Buddha was then in touch with the son as well. But alas, this son wasn't very receptive to the Dharma, really, and the Buddha thought he was more or less a lost case. He didn't really convert to the Buddha's teachings. This is King Ajatasattu. Is that right? Would you say? You were studying in the Samanyapala Sutta, weren't you? Yeah. But King Passenadi is a very different character. It seems like King Passenadi is the king of a small kingdom in ancient India. When we think of these kings, maybe they're more like a chieftain in our terms. The thing is, they're about the same age. The Buddha and King Passenadi. And King Prasenjit, I imagine him as being like an ancient Indian version of Boris Johnson, actually. But perhaps not quite as bright. So there's a story of the conversion of King Prasenjit. Prasenjit, young king, visits the Buddha, who's, you know, celebrity ascetic of his day. Young Buddha, obviously, and asks the Buddha, "How come a young man like you can claim to be awakened? Usually, people who claim to be awakened are a bit older, and it's a big thing to claim. So, what's going on?" And the Buddha replies, "There are four things which you should that should be respected, even though they are young. Firstly, a warrior." A well-trained warrior, even if young, is very dangerous. A serpent. A young serpent, you should really respect one. They're you know, very unpredictable. A fire. Yeah. A small fire should certainly be respected, because if you don't respect it, it may grow very large. And finally, a virtuous ascetic. So even though young, a virtuous ascetic should be respected. And the idea there seems to be that the belief that they can curse you. Yeah, so it's a slightly odd reason to respect an ascetic, that you could be the object of a curse. Anyway, this impressed Prasenjit, and he duly went for refuge to the Buddha. But having said that, I get the impression, and they continue to meet over the years, King Prasenjit and the Buddha. There's lots of stories, a lot of them quite delightful, but I get the impression that King Prasenjit, he never really got the Dharma or anything. Think of Boris Johnson, but not as intelligent. It's like, he just liked the Buddha. He thought he was a kind of good guy, and he was just busy being king. And there's a lovely story where, on one occasion, King Prasenjit of Kosala ate a bucket of cooked rice. And after he'd eaten, he went to see the Blessed One, breathing heavily. Having greeted the Blessed One, he sat to one side. And the Buddha spoke the following stanza. "A person who is always mindful and knows how much food is necessary reduces discomfort, slowing age and guarding their span of life." A person who is always mindful and knows how much food is necessary reduces discomfort, slowing age, and guarding their span of life. And King Prasenjit said, he had a young attendant and said, "Memorise that verse and recite it to me every time food is served, and I'll give you £100 a day." And he did that. And he kept up a regular diet of at most a mug of cooked rice. And at a later time, King Prasenjit, his body nicely slim, stroking his limbs with his hand, uttered this inspired utterance: "The Blessed One is compassionate to me in two ways, in relation to the good in the present life, as well as in relation to the next life." So, did you know that the Buddha was a diet advisor, or a dieting advisor? He could have written a book called "I Can Make You Thin," or something more Buddha-like. So this is the kind of relationship they had, very, very straightforward, really, wouldn't you say? So that King Prasenjit came to the Buddha for rather down-to-earth advice on how to live. On another occasion, King Prasenjit was hanging out with the Buddha, and he asks the Buddha, "You see these lot of ascetics passing by. They're quite a dirty lot, with long fingernails, unkempt hair, hairy armpits, apparently." King Prasenjit says, "Can you tell if they're arahants or not?" Yeah, which is to say, can you tell if they're enlightened beings? And the Buddha explains to him, "Do you know what? It's only by living with people for a long time that you can really learn how awakened they are. You shouldn't just go by appearances. Just because people have long fingernails and look the part, may not mean they're really awakened. You have to live with them, see how they live, see how they deal with problems, yeah? See how they deal with arguments, and only then can you decide. And King Pasenadi says, "Very good, Lord. In fact, they're my spies." Yeah? They're my spies. So he's got a bunch of spies dressed up as ascetics, who of course can move around quite freely and can gather information about neighbouring kingdoms. So it's not as though King Pasenadi sort of gets the Dharma, do you see what I mean? It's like, but he never catches the Buddha out. And then there's a lovely story, this is the final story here. It's said that they're both 80. I think that sounds a bit too old to me. The Buddha's said to have died when he was 80. I mean, 80 is old in those days. So let's say they're both old. Yeah? So King Pasenadi's been king for a long time. The Buddha's been Buddha for a long time. So King Pasenadi visits the Buddha. He goes to visit him. And when he enters the Buddha's hut, or the hut where the Buddha's living, he prostrates himself at the Buddha's feet. He starts kissing his feet and stroking them with his hands, crying. And the Buddha says, why are you giving me such tremendous devotion? And King Pasenadi explains that everything he hears about the Buddha shows him to be a respected and excellent teacher. Whereas he, King Pasenadi, finds it difficult to stop people talking over him. Everyone's extremely respectful for the Buddha and no one talks over him. And even his chief ministers, who are quite loyal to King Pasenadi, when they sleep, they always sleep with their heads towards the Buddha. Yeah? Whereas nobody does sleeps with their heads toward King Pasenadi. So my sense is that in the end, King Pasenadi found that you can imagine that the situation of being a king in those days, it's very hard to find peers, people who will really just be naturally your friend. And the Buddha was that for the king. He wasn't overawed by somebody of power and influence. He wasn't bothered by threats or anything like that. But he was willing to speak the truth very straightforwardly, also from his own understanding of things, to the king. And in the end, the king came to realise that, in a certain sense, the Buddha was the better person. Yeah? I mean, obviously we need kings, but overall, the Buddha, as a spiritual teacher, was the more, as it were, the more developed human being, and he recognised that. So, in a sense, he was a devoted disciple, although he didn't show any signs of having, in some sense, mastered the doctrine. So, I'll leave you with these three characters: Ambapali, the successful woman of the day, as it were, whose friendship with the Buddha gave her a bigger perspective on life, and Angulimala, the serial killer, who was saved, as it were, from his own wrong style of life by someone who was willing to connect with him. And King Pasenadi, a kind of powerful, kind of attractive character, whom the Buddha was willing to befriend and be a peer to. And these three characters give us a sense of how the Buddha's influence in the India of his day was much more than as a sort of spiritual teacher of harmless souls like ourselves, perhaps, who are interested in the spiritual life. He was able to connect with all sorts of different people, wherever they were. So that was what I wanted to get across. And we're going to have the chance to have some discussion in groups now. So the question I'm going to set, as it were, set or invite you to discuss in your groups is, what is it that appeals to you in the Buddha's teaching? What is it that appeals to you? in the Buddha's teaching. It's a chance to sort of look at whatever the Buddha's teaching from a different angle, perhaps. Thanks very much.